Fashion doesn't have to be a seasonal thing. It can be something that comes in waves. And I love hearing stories from customers who tell me about the clothes that they've been wearing for 10 years and that they still love. I love hearing all their stories.
Yeah.
It's really, really satisfying.
We are joined by Australian designer and retailer Celia Morris. For anyone who lives in Sydney, and particularly in the inner west around Newtown, the name Dragstar may well be familiar. This indie fashion label has been a local institution since the early 90s, loved for its quirky, cool collections, its great colours and prints. But you don't have to know and love Dragstar to get this story, because this is the story of so many independent designers in so many places. You know what I'm talking about, these local heroes who make their clothes in their own hometowns. So this is a Who Made Your Clothes story, and it's a small is beautiful story. It's about keeping local garment manufacturing alive, recognizing the value in short supply chains, in being able to meet your maker who's just up the road. It's about how it is possible to make fashion right here onshore in Australia or wherever you may be listening. Celia, welcome.
Thank you.
For those listeners who might not be aware of what Dragstar is, do you want to just tell us a bit about what kinds of clothes you make and who you make them for?
Yeah, sure. When I initially started the label, it was just t-shirts. And I had a stall at the market, so it was pretty basic stuff. And it was quite sporty leisure wear for young people. And I guess as the years have passed, the fashion has changed, but it's intrinsically the same feel.
I was very interested in this idea that if you have a consistent style,
yeah,
it doesn't have to be the same every season identically, yeah, but it's just this kind of coherence.
Yeah.
That what it means is you don't have that fast fashion thing where stuff is seasonally obsolete.
Yes.
So people buying your clothes can keep wearing them next season without feeling like, oh, this is past it.
Yes.
And so I wondered if that was purposeful in a design perspective.
Originally, no. I think the fact that I never studied fashion helped me because I never knew I was supposed to design a range. So I have always designed pieces. And because I haven't ever really wholesaled or designed a range, I've constantly just made pieces to fit in with previous pieces. And now how I approach it is I call it the wardrobe, where I have quite a lot of customers who've shopped with me for many years. Everything that they've ever bought from me, if they come into the shop today, everything in the shop will go back with everything they've ever bought.
See, that's actually a radical, sustainable idea, even if it wasn't couched in those terms to begin with.
Well, it works really well because women who, when they start a new job, they can come in and buy a new shirt, but they know that they've already got two skirts and a pair of pants and a jumper that will all go well with that because the look works well together. But we design things to last. To me, quality is really, really important. It's one of the most important things, that it's got to last. Otherwise, what's the point? You don't want your clothes to fall apart. You should get it, like I always say, with my slouch pants, my pencil skirts, which I remake year in, year out, and I might slightly alter the waist height. Over the years, the sizes have gotten bigger as we've all gotten bigger. But the fabric I use for my general workwear, you should get 6 years out of it. I always give my customers washing instructions. Don't hang it in the sun. Don't warm wash it. Don't tumble dry it. You've got to give them the hints to help them keep the garments going. Hand wash your knitwear. You know, take care of your things and they'll take care of you, they'll last.
That is powerful. I mean, in today's terms, we're talking here about fashion revolution, which is now in its fourth year, and the messaging around that, which began with supply chains and began commemorating the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh, in Dhaka. it's now grown to incorporate a kind of broader sphere of ethical and sustainable fashion. Now we're talking about not just who made your clothes, but where is the true cost of those clothes? How should we value them? How can we keep them out of landfill? How can we look at the supply chain with regards to fabric production? All of those things are in the conversation now. When you think about sustainable fashion, and in particular FashRev, why do you think it's gained so much momentum?
Because women who shop with me, for instance, they're intelligent and they care about the future. They've taken an interest in these things because they like to know where their clothes come from. And the very fact that the questions started to be raised makes people ask it. And it's one of those great things that Fashion Revolution brings up. It doesn't overcomplicate things. It just makes you stop and ask, where did your clothes come from?
Yeah.
Have a think about it. And like I have really noticed a difference in my customers. I mean, a lot of them have always specifically shopped with me because I am Australian made, but there's no point shopping with me because I'm Australian made unless you like the aesthetic. So that's another thing. It's hand in hand. But
the design has to be just as strong as the messaging.
Yeah, it does. It does.
But you've pumped up the messaging in recent years. I've noticed that you use the phrase ethical and
it's
ethical
true.
Production on it your is, website.
It's true, we do now because people are interested, and I think it's really important that they know people who have just come across the brand, that it's just a brand to them, it's just a shirt or a skirt. But when they have an understanding of where it came from, how it was created, where it was made, that the fabric was printed down the road, that the knitwear was made down the road, people are really excited about that. So I do try and incorporate the message of where we make our clothes. I put it in the Instagram. I try and put it on the website, the Facebook. We're going to be doing a bit more of that just to give people more idea, maybe making some videos of some of the factories that we use, some of the printing procedures. Because people really, they love to know that they're buying something so authentic and so, like, ethical.
I love how you talk about specific garments on your online store and tell quite deep detail about how some of those things were made. I was looking at your branch print dress, which is beautiful.
Yes.
But you tell us that was screen printed in Leichhardt.
Yes.
So not just locally, you're telling us exactly where.
Publisher Textiles.
Right.
Great guys. They also have their own brand now that they're making. And they print beautiful wallpaper and yardage prints. They do work for a lot of small local designers, and they're a great bunch of young people with a lot of enthusiasm for small fashion, Australian industry, and everything that we believe in. So we work really well together, and it's just really, we are really lucky to have them there, because so many of the other people have closed down, and it just gets harder and harder. So when there's a young group coming up and, like, we feel that they have a good, strong future, we can all work together, that just makes a job for someone like me much easier.
That's so fantastic. I know that you're also producing knitwear in Marrickville. I wasn't even aware that we had a knitting factory.
We have one. Bill is this great guy. He's been knitting jumpers for Dragster for nearly 20 years.
Wow, so you've really been working with this team for a long time.
We have a long relationship. We've made clothing together for a long time, and I often send other labels down there too. So he
sharing information is really key to this, isn't it?
He's actually a lot busier now than I think he thought he'd be, because I think he's one of the last local so they knit the fabric, they cut, and they make. Now the trick is getting the wool. It's the big problem. The last supplier of yarn, I think, has closed, so he has to pre-order it. So now...
So where is it coming from? Where is he ordering it from?
I don't know exactly, but I know that I missed a deadline, and so I have no wool.
And we're the biggest wool-producing nation in the world.
Yeah, I know. And
we're exporting it. I mean, I know that's the case with the raw wool that we grow in Australia. It's exported.
I had a long conversation this morning with one of my textile makers. He knits almost stripes. He was talking to me about wool and how many chemicals are involved with dyeing it and
scouring it and finishing it. I mean, it is a very chemical-laden process
and
traditionally.
And we're happy to just send the problem away. Australian government won't even allow us to do that in Australia because it's so bad. So we just send it offshore and it's their problem in their rivers. Oh my God, there is.
I mean, supply chains are so complicated, aren't they? Because you can make locally
I say Australian made, but the wool, it was treated overseas, but it's an Australian made garment. I guess it's like food when you have a muesli bar and it says Australian made from local and source products.
Some elements of that are going to be from international suppliers, and that's why international supply chains are so complicated.
Yes.
I think the best that we can do as designers or producers in Australia is just try to take those baby steps.
Just
be more transparent.
That's right.
Yeah.
All we can do is try.
And ask more questions of the suppliers.
Yes. Since I started, there have been lots of different manufacturers of fabrics, ribs. There's a place called Pet Lee I used to buy so much fabric from, like when I used to make a trillion rib scoop neck t-shirts and they closed down. I was like, oh, I can't get my rib now. There was a big supplier of fabric in Botany. They closed down. I bought, I think, enough fabric to last me 3-4 years. I'm coming to the end of that.
I know that you also bought up the last supply of buttons from the only button maker in Sydney that closed. I'm not sure when that was. Can you tell us about that story?
Oh, yeah. So they make these nylon buttons that I like. I've always liked the style of these buttons because they're very 70s. And plus, being the nylon, you can buy them in white and dye them any color you like. So I've always, as long as I've made a garment with buttons, which probably didn't happen straight away, it was really t-shirts at the beginning, I could get these buttons, get them dyed to match the fabric.
Locally,
yep, all locally, in small quantities. And yeah, then the factory got taken over and then they moved it out west and I was still buying these buttons. And then I got a phone call saying, oh, there's no money in this anymore, we're closing down. So I said, well, can I just come out and grab some buttons? So
your house full of buttons.
My studio has boxes and boxes of these beautiful white and black buttons, so I can dye them up as I need them. But they will, I think, last a while. But yeah, it's really sad when industry closes like that. It's not going to start up again.
I mean, it's one of the biggest challenges
it got
facing.
Doubled up.
Yeah.
Really good. And the,
how
yeah.
do designers make here when the suppliers and the makers are closing
the
and moving on?
I can tell you.
Tell them. But I mean, I was interested to actually ask you about if you're finding those challenges are also applicable when it comes to cut and make, and are machinists becoming in shorter supply? Is it getting harder to find local makers?
I think they're probably out there, but it's finding them. And they're not the factories that they used to be. So in the time I've been working in the fashion industry, I have seen massive, massive, massive changes. So factories is closing down one after the other after the other because there was nothing to keep them open. As all the brands have gone offshore,
chasing the cheapest needle.
Well, and it's not their fault in a way because the government, like, got rid of all the tariffs. I have a lot of makers who could tell you a lot more about this and what happened when there are fingers pointed all over the place. But I was just sort of starting out when the tariffs were, there was still, I think, about a 10% tariff on imported goods. When I started on my dragster brand, I had a shop in Bondi.
And that was the early 90s?
Yes. And then that went, and then it was just boom. The imports just started flooding.
So flooded with cheaper imports.
The markets changed, like everything changed, the shops changed. And there are still some great brands making locally. Like I know Q have really done an amazing job keeping product local. They do some offshore. Bonds tried to hold on as long as they could.
We know that Bonds have gone. What would you say to listeners who want to support the local industry, and where do they start? How do they know who is making locally and who's doing a good job, and what would you suggest they do to start making those more informed choices about Made in Australia? Is it about label reading? Is it about research online?
A really quick and easy place to check out would be Instagram under the hashtag Australia Made Fashion.
And then research through that.
Have a look. I mean, you need to like the label. You need to like what they're doing. And then there are so many great online shops now. You can research a lot of stuff at a quick amount of time.
And ask brands, ask designers. If people are not willing to get back to you and share this information, then I would say move on to the ones who are.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, you should shop with a brand that fits your personal ethos. Yeah, there aren't a lot of brands doing what we do, so it shouldn't be too hard to find us. There's a few around my shop down in South King Street, Newtown, for anyone who wants to come down and have a look.
But also you're stocking the work of smaller designers, jewellery designers, accessories makers too, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, originally I used to make a lot of my own accessories. I used to sell a lot of leather bags.
And did you make them here?
They were all made locally by Boris, who still makes my leather products.
In Redfern?
Yes.
I know about Boris in Redfern.
Yeah, well, Boris is
there's
one
a
of
leather
the last
maker in Redfern. Yeah, and you can have jackets made, you can have bags made.
Yeah, he does stuff for the mass market, well, the smaller mass market. But I can't make any money now selling my accessories, so I can't compete with the leather bags that come in from offshore now. So we really don't make many bags anymore. So but now what we do sell lots of is shoes. So we're selling the beautiful Troventorp clogs, which are ethically made in Sweden.
Using sustainably produced wood for the soles, and then what's the leather?
Well, they're...
Is it vegetable tanned? Do you know?
I think they do some vegetable tan, but I just love the way that when you get the clogs, you can see the nails in them. There's still someone there hammering the little nails into the clogs.
I went to see a brand called Swedish Has-Beens when I went to Stockholm, and she was explaining to me how these shoes are designed to be repaired. So she's got shoes from the 70s that were her mother's, and then she'd replicated that design in her new brand, which I think you can buy in London and online. But these shoes are designed to be repaired, so if you lose a nail, a cobbler can put your nail back in. If the soles wear down, then if you take them back to Swedish Has-Beens, they can give you slivers of wood to fix them.
Wow.
So I think
that's handy.
I don't think
we've got many people who can do that here, but...
Well, cobblers though, I mean, I don't know about clogs, but we ought to be supporting cobblers as well, because that's skilled repair work,
that's
isn't it?
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Do you sell saltwater sandals
We do sell saltwater sandals. And the reason I think they are a great shoe is because they last. They will last you years. And I have a few pairs myself. And they really wear really, like, compared to some cheap, nasty sandals you can buy that you get one season out of, you're just better off buying a product that will last. It's just so much better for the environment to buy something that you'll get quite a few years out of. And I always say, if you maybe buy two pairs so you can spread
the wear,
the love. Mm-hmm. Celia,
I wonder if I might take you back to the beginning of when you began Dragstar, and if you could paint a bit of a picture about what the local brand landscape was like then.
Yes. Well, I probably will start off by saying I'm an accidental fashion designer, because I wasn't intending to do this, what I'm doing now. I was going to be a photographer, and just around the time I was graduating from my graphic design degree, digital photography started to come in, and I was working as an assistant. I remember the day I was an assistant and we were shooting a car, and the photographer said, well, that's okay, the sky doesn't need to be blue because we'll put that in later. And I just thought, well, this is a waste of my time.
Wow.
And that was when I decided I don't think I'll make a career in photography, because I was much more into film and shooting what I saw. So that's when my hobby, which was market stores and making T-shirts, started to have more relevance.
So did you sew those T-shirts yourself?
I never sewed my own T-shirts, because you always needed special machinery for ribbing and hems and everything. So it was very specialized.
So were they printed? Can you describe
them? So the first T-shirts I ever made, before I was making t-shirts, I was just going to the Bonds Factory outlet store and buying some of their old 70s t-shirts that were still available back then.
Gosh.
And I used to put vintage transfers on them. So I had,
did you?
I used to find these great old, you know, panel van transfers, and I used to put them on and sell them at Glebe markets. And then I was finding the stock of these cool shaped t-shirts was disappearing. Then it became obvious that what was I going to put my transfers on, because the shape had to be right. And that's when my friend Jonas Allen, I attribute him to me getting into manufacturing. He has the Organic Tea Project. He was a uni friend of mine, and he said, look, you've got to come to this factory in Surry Hills. There's these guys, the Chenzai brothers, they make these t-shirts. Bring your t-shirt that you like the shape and give it to them and see how you go. And that's when I started getting t-shirts made. It was so easy.
That kind of story of like just arty renegade startups, it seems like it's much harder in today's climate to be able to take an idea like that and make it fly.
There's not like a factory up some wooden stairs in Surry Hills that is full of opportunities anymore. Those days are sadly gone. But that was just how easy it was. And I just used to get bags and bags and bags of these cool t-shirts made and sell them at the markets. I think I sold them for $15, and I think they cost me about $5. And then people would say at the market, so have you got black? Have you got a black t-shirt? And if two people asked me, I'd say, next week I'll have black. So I'd make them in black.
But this is it's a perfect example of the benefits of a short supply chain, isn't it? That you can go to the up the stairs in Surry Hills and say, can we get two more in black? And that's a business plan.
Oh, yeah, but I'd order 30 and then they'd sell out. I used to have these great stalls at Paddington Markets. I'd turn up with my big bags of t-shirts, and at the end of the day I'd just have empty hangers. It was great. And I had no overheads because I didn't have, like, I only had a small studio. Oh, those were great days.
Those were great days.
That was before the imports came.
So now, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back over, how many years since 1991, looking back over those years, what have you learned about production and about the fashion industry looking back over that now?
I've learned that you really need to be passionate about what you're doing in order to stick to it, because it's not easy. But I've also learned that your customers inspire you, because what you do because they get such a thrill out of it. You do it for them almost. Fashion doesn't have to be a seasonal thing. It can be something that comes in waves. And I love hearing stories from customers who tell me about the clothes that they've been wearing for 10 years and that they still love. I love hearing all their stories. Yeah. It's really, really satisfying.
I mean, I think we can often forget that fashion is, you know, when we're looking at some of the ugliness behind some of the production of, for instance, fast fashion, or if we look at rivers turning blue through denim production, it can be a very gloomy picture.
Mm.
But what we forget, or what's easy to forget, is that fashion is such a human thing. It's communication, it's identity, it's a kind of great celebratory tool for making connection. It can be, if we could just harness that and use it for good.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting that people are asking more questions now. I mean, it's scary what's going on with disposable fashion, but I think there are enough smart, intelligent women out there to make a change and change their shopping habits, the purchasing habits, and, you know, wear more upcycled clothes, wear more op shop clothes, stop buying $3 shirts at Target, and think about your next purchase. You don't need to buy stuff that you don't wear. I say to customers when they're in the shop trying things on, if you don't think you'll wear it all the time, I really don't think you should buy it, because
it'll sit
in your cupboard
and
be wasted. I just think it's important that you love what you buy and that you put it on and feel amazing, comfortable, and, you know,
and you have no intention of throwing it away.
But no, you don't want to throw it away. You love it in your wardrobe there, and you're going to wear it. That's what clothing should be. It should make you feel great, should make you look good, but treat it with some respect.
Powerful words from someone who actually did begin their career upcycling vintage t-shirts in the 70s. I love it.
Yes. Well, they weren't vintage, but they were They were secondhand.
Yeah, dead stock.
They were definitely dead stock.
Let's just finish by maybe you could share a little bit about what your goals for Dragstar are now and perhaps through the lens of communicating more about ethical production or sustainability.
Well, my biggest bugbear at the moment is single-use plastic. So my our project this week, we get many projects. I don't want to overwhelm everyone with things. Our project this week, and this is something that I think a lot of shop owners do and they don't even know, they haven't thought about it, is how you swing tag your fashion garments with the plastic tags. And I've just been swing tagging away.
So with the gun that fires the plastic through.
Yeah, for years and years and given it no thought. Here I am like ranting about plastic bags and straws and everything else in my life. And it took a friend of mine to say to me, you know, you really should have a look at those plastic tags. And I was like, oh my God, yes, we should. So we're going to get rid of them. And I love that she mentioned it to me because it wasn't in my sight of like thought.
Yeah.
So that's our project this week. So everyone out there with a shop, that's a little thing we can all
do. Isn't it? And the little things can make such a difference.
Because they end up, those little bits of plastic, they just end up in the gutter.
Yeah.
This end is up what we have ocean. To stop.
And I've never thought about that either, actually. I think a lot about plastic bags.
Yeah, me too. I'm obsessed with plastic bags. But, yeah, so there's something.
I love
that's
it.
A short-term goal for
so
us.
So if any listeners out there are working in retail, perhaps you could pressure your employers to rethink the plastic tagging.
Yeah, for sure.
And the ribbon and the pin, which can be reused. I mean,
absolutely.
I reuse safety pins all the time.
Exactly. Totally.
Love it.
When I was about 12, I had a stall at Balmain Markets selling
earrings.
At 12?
Yes. You were a mini entrepreneur.
So it wasn't so much that. It was more that I was making things and wanting to sell them. I wasn't inspired by wanting to make money. It was just that I wanted to make stuff. And no, my mum never discouraged me. So I went up there with my little board and I stuck all my earrings on and I sold them all for $5 or something. And
what did you make
so
them out of?
Things like straws and beads. And I used to go to this place called the Bead Company when it was upstairs in a warehouse in Surry Hills and spend my pocket money buying beads and making earrings.
But I think that's such a universal story, isn't it, with designers and creators that they were crafty or they loved making stuff when they were kids.
I think it's fascinating seeing, like, I'd forgotten about it and I looked back years later and I was like, that's right, I did that. It must be something about wanting to make stuff and bring it out for people.
Yeah, creative impulse.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine you at 12 in the markets. I love it. And coming home with all your money, even though you weren't in it for the money. And also upcycling if you're using bits of old straw.
Straws, fluoro straws.
I always love this word upcycling because it didn't used to be in the popular parlance.
It's
but of course
word.
We've always done it.
Upcycle, recycle.
I just
love
didn't
it.
Use that word. You know, people have always made something out of some old thing, some new thing,
yes.
out of something that's been discarded. But now we have this great term for it. But
yeah,
I think
it's
kind
good.
Of. It's just a thing we've always done,
I've just registered a new business name too for my kids' shop, which I'm going to be making, and it's called Little Eco Warriors. And just going to be little T-shirts, ethically sourced and made, with prints on them saying things like, I don't use plastic straws.
Stop it. I love it. Political messaging.
Yeah.
Made ethically.
Yeah.
Super cute
for
and
kids,
trendy.
Because you have to start with the kids. That's where the real message is the strongest.
So it's going to be called?
It's called Little Eco Warriors.
Little Eco Warriors.
Yeah. It's on Instagram. Check it out.
Genius, I will. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for talking
to
us today, Celia.
That was so easy. You're so great to talk to. That was interesting.
Who Made My Clothes is a co-production between Jackrabbit FM and Fashion Revolution Australia and New Zealand. It's hosted by me, Claire Press from Wardrobe Crisis, and produced by Brooke McCallery. Editing is by Ryan Pemberton and Brooke McCallery. And you can find out more about the show and about all the brands that we feature by hopping onto the Fashion Revolution website.
Thank you to the Hipstones for the music. This track is Read Your Mind from the album Wise Man, available on iTunes or Spotify. To hear more, go to thehipstones.com. To find out more information and to take part in Fashion Revolution Week, head to the website. It's fashionrevolution.org and you need to search for Australia or New Zealand. On social media, search for the hashtags Who Made My Clothes and Fashion Revolution, and you'll find heaps of inspiration as to how you can get involved.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.